Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times. Now with goals.
Hello and welcome to the game from The Times, the place where you can get every goal from every game in the 2013-14 Premier League season. I am Gabriel Marcotti. I'm here to break down the first weekend of action in the Premier League. And to do this, I am joined by Matt Dickinson, Tony Cascarino, and from the Great Northeast, it's George Culkin. No Rory K. Smith on the show this week, so we're all in a better mood. But let's start at a place where they're not so delighted, the Emirates. Dicko, I'd want to say that this is a script we've sort of seen before, but we kind of have seen it before. And, you know, people saying spend some freaking money, since I'm sure that's what they were saying, and having a go at Wenger and generally being very, very unhappy. I want to ask you, would the fans have been as unhappy if Arsenal had won that game?
Would they have been unhappy? Well, of course, they'd have been less enraged by Saturday, but equally they've been still asking the nagging, repetitive, as you say, we feel like we've been asking it for the last 5 years, question of remember that 50, 60, 70, 80 million quid we talked about. Arsene Wenger, I know, was speaking to one sort of scout from a top scout from another club a week or so ago and saying, well, I'm actually pretty happy with my squad, and I'm trying to sign a couple of people, and if they don't happen, I'm not going to panic, which will only alarm Arsenal supporters even more. I think, you know, the fact is, A, they've got an issue with strengthening the team. B, they've still got an issue with defensive organisation, looking at particularly, obviously, the third goal. And, you know, they've just got a whole, probably bigger issue, just with a sense of direction about the club, a sense of direction among the players, the fans, about where this club is going, and it's not going forwards.
Amazing. Even without Stuart Robson on the word on the show, the words Arsenal and defensive organization still seem to creep in there. Cass, you were a striker who faced opposing defenses. If I were to put my Arsene Wenger hat on, I might point out to you that despite what evil people like Stuart Robson and occasionally Matt Dickinson say about our defensive organization, we actually conceded very few goals last summer, and that was without one of those, you know, nasty kick everything that moves defensive midfielders that people wanted us to buy not that long ago. And that maybe in this game we were simply undone by a bad refereeing decision.
I wouldn't go 100% on that. I mean, I do feel, Gab, if you watch the game and the problems that Gabriel Agbonlahor calls Arsenal.
My namesake.
Yeah, you know, the way he just devastated. He had one of them games that he literally, like Paul Lambert said, unplayable. And he took them everywhere they didn't want to go. With that, Lovis Loon last year, we all talked about Chesney. Arsene Wenger even dropped him last year. So there was problems in his goalkeeping area. And I think also with the comments of the end of the week, and they might have been exaggerated slightly, that players he didn't feel the right ones could get to the club, or the quality he felt, the calibre of player he needed, and who is out there. It sent shockwaves through the press, really, with, well, hold it a minute, your job is to find players, and there are players out there. All great clubs have to go and buy better players, or players that come in and be can do a service for you and make you a better team. And I think that all added up with the way they played at the weekend. They were okay. There were some good things about Arsenal, and I thought Giroud, who, you know, Arsenal keeps saying on they want a centre forward. I thought, you know, Giroud showed that, especially at the end of last season, that he could easily get sort of 10, 15, maybe even 20 goals this year, because he looked a far better player by the end of last year than he did certainly at the start of last season. So I did feel there were some eye-opening things that happened in the game. And they've conceded three, Gab. You know, and I don't think it was the biggest surprise that Villa went there and played the way they did with their front three, with their pace. And Arsenal couldn't really deal with it, especially Agbonlahor.
I should point out that some of us, of course, were bigging up Villa and Paul Lambert last week on this very podcast. George, what struck me is sometimes you get I want to get from you how I should read this, because Wenger came out with one of those quotes that, you know, sets you up for ridicule.
Yes, I know what you're going to say, because I've written this down myself.
Did you want to read the quote or the selected excerpts?
Well, I presume it's the same one, but and I won't, forgive me if I don't do the accent, but even if you go on the Eiffel Tower and you throw the money away, you play with the players you have. Was that the quote that you were going to mention?
Yeah, that was the setup, and then the part about how, you know, they have scouted every single footballer in the world, and they're working 24 hours a day to bring in footballers, and, you know, when he says, what players, you know, basically implying there's nobody out there.
And at the end of that, you then bid for Luis Suarez. I don't sort of quite understand that. I mean, particularly when...
That's the thing, George. That's the thing which gets me about this. And I'm sorry, but the three guys that they have pursued this summer, right? He talks about the great scouting, blah, 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 right? The three guys they pursued this summer, they played for Real Madrid, Bayern Munich, and that small club we like to call Liverpool. I mean, come on.
Yeah, and the sort of huge strength of those early years of Arsene Wenger was, you know, certainly not bringing in people that we'd never heard of, because we had, but sort of, you know, looking down a little level and maybe trying to find people who had something to prove or hadn't quite done it at the club they were at, and then moulding them into brilliant world class talent. So yes, that was a strange comment, and I did think the kind of Eiffel Tower thing was a bit alarming. Obviously, I wasn't there to hear it, and I don't know what the context was, but why you would want to go on the Eiffel Tower and throw your money away, or then play players on the Eiffel Tower? You know, why not just stay at home and sign some footballers?
Now, but
jump off the Eiffel Tower. Maybe that's it.
No, but George, you've dealt with some situations like that. When you see that, does that strike you as a manager who's losing his cool, or is it a manager who's trying to maybe deflect attention because he's really working on some kind of brilliant plan, the way Kinnear was when he went on his rant?
Yes, please let's not get started on that quite so early. My own paranoia will kick in at that point. I just thought it was very strange. I mean, I suppose if you're Arsene Wenger, every single press conference that you'll have done this summer, pre-season, and then now will be about spending money. Are you going to spend money? Yes, I am. Yes, we are. Yes, we definitely are. Hasn't quite happened yet. Why aren't you spending money? Well, we're trying to. And so I can understand why he would sort of get irritable about that, particularly when sort of over the course of the summer he's trying to mould the players he's got and you know would obviously like to concentrate on them. I mean, the problem, of course, is that they've got rid of 17 players as well, and you know, although many of them wouldn't have been featuring in the first team or around that, that means that a team which needed strengthening is now weakened, and you know, we've seen that with injuries to Oxlade-Chamberlain already, someone who was playing very well in that first game, and you know, the peril of not bringing in new players by the start of the season kind of immediately becomes apparent.
Dicko, help me diagnose this. I need your take, because there's going to be a certain reaction. It's going to be, all right, time to get rid of Wenger. But as I kind of see it, I actually think, despite this morning of the defensive organization, I still think that Arsenal, the Wenger's relatively clear-headed on the pitch. Arsenal play good football. I think the problem is whoever their transfer guru is, and it's a person, as I understand it, whose name is Dick Law. I'm not making the name.
No, well, it's not. It's Arsene Wenger. I mean, Arsene Wenger.
So
Arsene
who is
Wenger.
Dick Law? Is that just a name I've made up? Because it sounds
ridiculous. Well, he's a guy who is in charge of contracts, and you know, for his, you know, which again, if you're looking at positives for Arsenal fans, I mean, which club has, you know, mishandled its contract renegotiations the worst? Well, it's Arsenal. I mean, Theo Walcott, they ended up paying more for Theo Walcott than they would have done just by giving him the contract earlier. They ended up obviously losing Robin Van Persie, which, you know, looks with ever, you know, has looked for the last year as possibly the worst bit of business any club could ever fathom. So, I mean, and this, you know, we're back to the same debates, because, you know, Arsene Wenger runs that club down to the, you know, choice of tiles in the bathroom and the loo paper, and you know, nothing happens without his say-so. And you know, when you're scouting, the problem is that he likes to cast the net far and wide, but is also famously dithering. You know, he likes to leave it to the 11th hour. He likes to scout a player a million times. And as you quite rightly said, it's not even as if he's sort of conjured up a gem from the Ivory Coast. He's come back to some very, very mainstream targets. So you've got an issue with the fact that, you know, Wenger has got probably more autonomy at that club now than any Premier League manager at any club.
Hmm. Fenerbahce, Champions League, home and away, Fulham, and then Tottenham, the next few games for Arsenal. And I don't know why, I get this feeling that the club has to have a bit of an iron fist about it, over transfers, over handling the contracts. Really, would you see Wayne Rooney being sold by Sir Alex Ferguson to Chelsea? Would he allow that transfer? Why? Because it'd hurt himself. He would make it even harder for him to win the Premiership, in his mind. So he doesn't want to sell to his rivals. Arsenal have got to become a far more of an iron fist club. Look at Daniel Levy at Tottenham. We all talk about the way, you know, he's done his business. He's done it with an iron fist that has made Tottenham a better football club.
Yes, and compared to Arsenal, Tottenham have all those Champions League appearances to talk about. And one of those.
I think, Gab, going forward, the club is looking a far better, well-constructed club than
you're
Arsenal.
Buying shares? You'd buy shares in Spurs over Arsenal right now?
I would buy Spurs.
The first thing, of course, is obviously the worse that Arsenal, you know, start, the more likely they are to, well, to spend money, whether that's out of panic or just sort of pragmatism.
Indeed, 2 years ago, in the last 36 hours of the transfer window, Arsenal signed no fewer than five players: Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, Mikel Arteta, Andre Santos, Park Chu-young, and Yossi Benayoun on loan. Did wonderful.
And we can say, well, what are we going to score him out of those five? Two hits.
One and a half, I think. Okay, now we get a word on Villa. We bigged him up last week, so there's no reason to big him up again. For those who don't understand, the reason we refer to him as Paul Lambert this week is that's what we call him when he does well. But Christian Benteke, I want to get a word from you because Benteke shares the first four letters of his name with Darren Bent, and you and Darren Bent are very close to each other. So this is a guy who wants to leave the club, but really wants a new contract, gets the big, fat new contract he wanted, and continues to produce, at least thus far. Does that say we don't always see that, right? Sometimes when you get your huge deal, players tend to take their foot off the gas a little bit, right? As Cass is nodding, he'd speak some experience.
Yeah, you can see that. You can see that happen. I mean, I think that there must have been huge trepidation at Villa when that sort of transfer request went in, because he sort of underpinned everything last season, and you know, what was a very difficult season, and certainly, I mean, it's a fairly obvious thing to say, but without his goals, they would have been relegated, and if he'd gone this summer, it would have plunged them back into a very difficult position. I mean, he looks like he's got everything. You know, huge power, good hunger. I mean, the very fact he was asking for a contract or kind of pushing to move, whichever way you want to look at it, after one year in the division, how comfortable does that make you feel? about his long term future. I'm not so sure, but you know, he looks a really good player.
But it's good that he signs a new contract, gets his money, and still starts playing hard. A little bit like Luis Suarez did last year, actually. Let's move on to Wales. In fact, Swansea and Manchester United. At some point, David Moyes had to go and actually manage a real game for Manchester United, and it happened, and he got a resounding victory. I can only imagine, and I'm sure he would say that he's always confident all along, but you know, it's one less thing to worry about to be able to go to Swansea and win so convincingly after a really testy, sort of, I thought, first 15, 20 minutes.
I mean, I thought, yes, you're right. I mean, they were under a bit of pressure. I thought, you know, we were looking at that midfield again, talking about returning to familiar problems. I thought, you know, the game looked like it was, Giggs was struggling to get in. Valencia looks, I just doesn't look like he's got his mojo back at all. And you know, you thought, this is going to be sticky. But then Van Persie scores that great goal. They get two in 3 minutes, and you know, the picture is transformed, and they run out comfortable winners. And you can't overstate just how sort of soothing that performance, that result will be. Because again, if you're talking about the last 2 weeks of the transfer window, Arsenal might be sort of panicked into various moves, and now Moyes, if you know, particularly if he gets another good result against a big game against Chelsea next week, can just make those decisions from a very much stronger place, you know, which given the pressure on him at the moment, you know, it will be hugely reassuring.
Welbeck last season scored one goal all season long. We all heard it. We all made the joke. Look, he doubled his goals tally, blah, blah, blah. But I thought, especially his the finish with a little chip over Michel Vorm, I thought that, like, this is pretty good. I'm not saying I didn't know he could do that, but he showed a lot of personality and he showed, you know, the ability to kind of stick to it. Should Moyes maybe stick to him and make him a feature every week?
Well, I did a piece in the paper on Saturday, Gab.
That's why I'm asking you.
Danny Welbeck, and it was incredible that this kid can't get 10 goals. Okay, I think he only made 17 appearances last year, and he was in and out of the team. But I look at him, and I think he's got so much to offer. You know, he's good in the air. He's got a good turn of pace. He's got an absolute desire and motivation to want to be better. He's far too unselfish. He's got to become more selfish inside the box and take opportunities that he's given. If he does, Danny Welbeck will have no problem at all getting 10, 15, and maybe a push, maybe get to closer to 20, because he's got the ability to do it. And I don't see him as a poor finisher. When I've seen him in front of goal, he's not bad.
Is that where he should play?
Well, I think he plays around. I mean, look, Van Persie was the one reason United, he is the guy that turned the game. You know, when you've got someone in as good as him who can do what he did, the two goals he got just typified, you know, it didn't half make it easy for you as a team when you've got someone who can produce moments of magic like he can. And then you've got someone like Welbeck, and I think he's got so much to offer. I think if you work at him, we could be looking back at Danny Welbeck in 3 or 4 years' time and seeing a regular 15, 20 goal a year man playing for United, because I do think he's got all the qualities. But he must get his stats higher, get more goals. If he doesn't, we're always going to think on a little bit of a negative side to Danny, because he does so many good things.
George, you saw young Welbeck up close when he was in your neck of the woods. Has he developed the way you expected?
Yeah, I mean, very much. I'm sort of, you know, lapsed into cliche. He sort of arrived a boy and left a man, and you could, Sunderland's, well, pretty good force and Sunderland had at that time, but you could see that he sort of had everything, and you know, they were desperate to keep him even at that stage, and it was never going to happen simply because you know, they viewed him back at Old Trafford as sort of having all the qualities. And I think the problem for him since then has been getting regular football. But you know, when you see him play like he did at the weekend, it is just that sort of last touch, that sort of hunger, ferocity in the area to get the ball and score that has been lacking. But my goodness, I think he's potentially a wonderful footballer. Yeah,
We've talked ourselves to death about Rooney, but I think we do need to mention the reaction he got when he came on, and admittedly, you know, this was an away game, but often you do get the more vociferous supporters at away games. And this is when people are going to make jokes about, you know, United fans coming from South Wales or whatever else. But the point here was he was supported by the crowd, and he played well, Cass, didn't he? Are we maybe thinking now that in the end, if nothing happens, he'll still be there, he'll still contribute, it's not going to be a big disruption and they'll extend his contract anyway, the way somebody, i.e. me, has been suggesting all along?
Well, he's had a long time to think, hasn't he, in the last couple of months. And I think if he really sits down and he's thought long and hard about leaving Manchester United, you know, it's a great football club. It's a team that's going to win things. OK, he's not in the team as much as he may be liked, or think he might even be not be used as much as he would like. But he's got to prove by playing as well to not be left out of the team.
As a player, with the reaction of
he'd be delighted with that. But that's only short-lived, Gab. Right. But, you know, he's got to prove. I mean, he's asked for two transfers. That's an incredible thing to do at United and still be there and still have the support of your fans. That's pretty amazing. But they love him because they know he's a good footballer and they want him to stay. They do want Rooney to stay. That's obvious. But he's got to now prove that, you know, that his heart is in the same place as theirs.
So much of this sort of you know, wanting to get away has been sort of stage managed and strings being pulled by agents and PRs. And I'm not saying that means Rooney doesn't want to leave. But you sort of felt, I mean, there was one bit at the end, he was walking off and one of the coaches was sort of beckoning at him to, you know, to stay around and sort of join in the high fives, and sort of Rooney made a little point of sort of shuffling off down the tunnel. But you almost felt his heart wasn't in it. I mean, you sort of felt like, you know, he's having to sort of tell himself, you know, I've got to look glum, I've got to look miserable, I've got to look like I'm sort of being held against, hostage against my will here. But the fact is, when he played, he got involved, and everything about his play underlined the fact that Man United would be mad to sell him unless Chelsea turn up with Mata, David Luiz and 20 million and offer them such a ridiculous deal that they can't resist it.
As we taped this morning, Tony Barrett, I think, is reporting that Everton, his favorite club, have turned down a combined bid of £28 million for Marouane Fellaini and Leighton Baines. Cass, can you help me figure this out from United's perspective? Because all summer long, they sort of chase Cesc and Thiago, and then they go for Fellaini, who's a completely different sort of player. And, okay, so Evra is pushing on, but now you wait till now. What, you don't like Evra anymore? If you've seen him, you've seen his preseason, you've seen what he's doing, you want to bid for Baines. And also, £28 million doesn't seem like a lot of money. I mean, it's marginally more than, I think, than what Everton paid for Fellaini in the first place. And he's not really gotten worse.
No, it's a real strange one. I mean, look, David Moyes was at the club. He knows their contract situations. He knows probably the price tag that. And one thing he always prided himself on, David Moyes, was getting the right prices for players when he left them, like people like Lescott. He got top dollar. And now it seems a much lower figure than, you know, we know they're worth. I mean, what's Baines, 29 now? You know, he's still a very good.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Left back. He's tried to obviously leave it as late as he can because deals get cheaper.
If you're Evra, what are you thinking?
Well, you'd be disappointed knowing that he's. But he must, you know, when you're at Old Trafford, you've always got your sort of. You've always got to look over your shoulder, Gab. Every player has to look over. When you play for big clubs, just go and look at the photos on the walls in the change rooms and around the corridors. You can see teams changing every 2 years and half the players are gone.
It's so one thing you when Sir Alex decides that you, Patrice Evra, are too old. Let's get somebody to replace you and not like this Butner or whatever who, you know, clearly he was one for the longer term thing. It's another thing when David Moyes, I'm just being cheeky here from Everett's perspective, when Mr. Nobody from Nowhere comes in, who's never won anything apart from Community Shield this year, and I think he also won the third tier with Preston, comes in and says to Patrice Evra, I like my friend Leighton Baines and his mod haircut more than you. Right?
Yeah. Well, that happens. Well, you know, everyone's got opinions, Gab. But I mean, you know, David Moyes obviously thinks that area needs strengthening. Right. I mean, we both know they're good players.
But what I'm saying is, and Dicko, maybe you can jump in here. If you're Evra, it's one thing. There's no real plan B, right? So if you don't get Baines, you're left with a situation where Evra knows that you would rather have Baines than him at left back.
Well,
you are a senior player at the club.
Yeah, which, you know, that might seem tough, but then equally, but you know, probably no player at the big club was sort of flogged and run to the ground quite like Evra in the last couple of years. I mean, I think he's looked absolutely shattered, going into the spring of certainly last season and maybe even the season before that, if memory serves me right. I think, you know, he's had a fantastic run of things, but I think they need to look at a future in that. And he was being linked with, I think he may have sort of glanced at moves abroad himself, to be honest. I think Monaco were sniffing around. So, no, you can't say, oh, well, David Moyes shouldn't be looking at a long-term future in that position. I think that would be naive.
Baines is not a long-term future. Baines is old himself. Baines is what, 29, 30?
So he's 28 and Evra is 32. So, I mean, there's a fair differential there. And
thank you, George.
And I think the way that Baines is playing at the moment, played last season, is, I mean, I can certainly understand why Moyes would want to take him to Old Trafford.
Okay, well, thank you for contradicting me, George. I really appreciate it.
Those fax things are quite useful sometimes.
Okay, thank you. So he turns 29 in a couple months. All right, thank you. All right, well done.
Four months, that's a third of a year.
December 11th. All right, just checking. So in our debate this week, I want to start with you, Dicko. You need to help me understand this, right? Why do teams have preseason training? I've been thinking about this, narrowed it down to three reasons. One is to go around the world and play in lucrative friendlies in Asia and North America. Okay, fine, we accept that. Two, traditionally, I guess, was to build up fitness because everybody got sort of lazy and sloppy in the off season. Although I'm not sure that really happens so much anymore that it's really that fitness based because players do tend to take better care of themselves these days than they used to. But the third reason, I would have thought, is to train, to actually practice at what you do, to build chemistry on the pitch, to bond off the pitch, to take certain tactical concepts on board, to get used to playing with each other. And with all this in mind, if this is something that's important, that we value, aren't clubs like Manchester City, who did all their buying early, going to have an advantage over clubs like Arsenal and United, who've been basically sitting on their behinds and really haven't signed anybody?
It's potentially a small advantage, I think. If you get your players in early, you can, particularly if you're rebuilding the shape of a team, or rebuilding. You know, got a new manager, changing the whole sort of philosophy, tactical strategies of the team. Then it can obviously be a not insignificant advantage. But I mean, ultimately, you hope if you're signing a player, he's there for obviously a few years at least. And so, I mean, clearly the most important thing is to get the right players. There can sometimes be good reasons why a transfer drags on. Sometimes a club might think, well, if I leave it to the last minute, I'm going to actually force them to sell at a different price. So there can be specific reasons why it makes sense. I think we would all wish that the transfer window coincided more with the start of the season. I don't know if there's any move along the European leagues. You know, obviously they can start at different weekends, but it would seem like it would make more sense if the transfer window was moved earlier, the closure was moved earlier, so that we could just sort of forget all this tittle-tattle and get on with the games.
I think what you say, Gab, is absolutely right. But it's only right in theory. I think if you asked any manager, they want to get their business done. When it's still May, when the season before is still fresh in people's mind, and they've got the whole summer then to kind of prepare with a new team. But you sort of, it's not as important as momentum. I can remember a couple of years ago when Steve Bruce, I think Sunderland signed 10 or 11 new players at Sunderland. Newcastle had a terrible summer, really horrible pre-season trip to America, and Alan Pardew was being asked questions about his Newcastle, a club in crisis. They went to Sunderland in the second game of the season, won, and ended up finishing fifth that season, and Steve Bruce was immediately under pressure and got sacked pretty quickly. So it's not a panacea, certainly. You would think it gives teams a small advantage, but it's not the most important thing for when the games actually kick off.
Cass?
Well, there's obviously lots of benefits for a player. From a player's perspective, getting to a club earlier, getting settled, get out of the hotel, get your kids in schooling, then being coached. And you go to a football club and every club I've been, the sessions have been different. Every coach trains you differently. So, you've got to get a feel. So there are some benefits. If you buy good players and you get them early, you're probably going to have to pay 20% more than at the start of July than you're going to pay at the end of August, because fees are dearer and clubs are aware of that. So,
but that can work both ways. I mean, at the end of August, you can get a bargain, but you can also end up paying a lot more, because if you're trying to buy somebody from a medium to larger club, they're not going to have time to go and buy a replacement, right? So you end up basically paying. It's the whole how much did Liverpool end up paying for Andy Carroll?
Yeah, I mean, but there are examples as well,
It can work both ways.
Yeah, it can. But I just think it's nice to fit in and be at a club earlier. Every time I've gone to a club and it's been a summer, right, it's been done quite early, I feel more settled by the time the season starts. Now, if you times that by 5 players or 10 players that you're bringing in, 9 times out of 10, we can all find examples of it contradicting, can't we?
No, of course.
Like George said, yeah. Like Sunderland did all their business. Right. That we can always find. I think all managers, as Jules said, would like to get it done early.
Because, Cass, you were a player. This is the part I don't understand, right? If Matthew Syed were here, he would start talking about 10,000 hours of focused training and whatever. Now, football clubs hardly train during the actual year, especially the ones who are in Europe, because, you might get 1.5 full training sessions a week during the season. So you can't really work on anything new. You can't really work on anything tactical during the season. I know, again, we're in England. Nobody likes to talk about tactics, and it's not really a priority for, it hasn't been traditionally, although I think that's changing. But I would have thought preseason is a time that you can do that. Now, you've played in France and stuff like that. Can you talk a little bit about the value of doing that?
Well, first and foremost, that I found when I got to Marseille that they certainly, the tactics and the style of play there was already adopted. They bought players to come. It's a bit like Sam Allardyce has done with going by Andy Carroll. They don't want to get a wide man in Stuart Downing that feeds him. The reasons that Liverpool bought them to be effective. So you buy players to fit each other, or you feel are going to complement each other. So you try and construct a team that everyone seems to play their role, and there's going to be a togetherness that everyone's going to look like it makes them look better. When I joined Millwall, they wanted me to play alongside Teddy Sheringham. So when I joined the football club, John Docherty said to me, "You're going to play alongside Teddy. I think you'll work well together." Nearly everybody on the outside world was It's crazy. Why would you? You know, neither of us are blessed with incredible pace. Both of us like to attack things from the crosses. And I found it really easy. Probably because he was a bloody gifted player. But, you know, John Doherty saw a partnership. He saw something that he thought would work together. And that's, you know, sometimes I just feel that, you know, getting players in and making them work is a very difficult art, and every club have different approaches from a player's perspective. I just think you've got to get in early and get it working as quick, and you'll probably find out quite soon if it's not going to work as well, Gab, because sometimes it looks perfect and looks cosy and it turns out the other way.
Dicko, what gets me is, I mean, as an example of what Cass just said, right, is If I'm United, right? So earlier this year, they pursued Thiago, and they pursued Cesc, who are, you know, generally smaller, gifted, creative passers. They have Cleverley, who's a little bit like that. Mm. And now, if they're bidding for Fellaini, they're looking to sign a player who's completely different from those guys.
But there is no doubt that Arsenal's transfer policy could be dictated by the mood in the next 2 weeks. Yeah. United's final price, look, they're clearly bidding for Fellaini. Whether they bid 20, you know, if you were bidding for Fellaini alone, whether you bid 23, 25 or 27 million, could, you know, I mean, that's a fine line decision, which is not based on vast, you know, you can't, there's no calculator that can give you the right or wrong answer to that.
So you
make a final decision on that based on a sense of urgency, a sense of desperation.
Matt, one thing we're all forgetting here, and this is so typical, and Gab talked about tactics. Now, maybe David Moyes has said, I want different options in my team. I don't want to have to play the same week. I have different oppositions and different styles to play against. I'm going to use a different type of player in certain games that have an effect. Like he used Fellaini against Man United at the start of last season as a centre-forward to play against Michael Carrick. You know,
yep.
So he's got the option then of going different style.
When is he going to teach these different styles? I mean, this is what...
Well, it's quite basic,
baffles me. No,
it's not rocket science.
No, this is the thing. This is the problem with you people. It's not rocket science.
No, it's not.
It's not. It's easy. Everyone can do it.
No, it's not.
Throw Harry in there. Anybody can do it. And then you sit back and you wonder, gee, why is it that, like, you know, the people who are actually doing something new and interesting and different and stuff that we sit there and we admire, they all tend to be elsewhere because you say it's not important, and then you don't train, and then you don't work on the tactical side of the game. And with a few exceptions, and I know there are exceptions
this
country and elsewhere.
Gab, there's many a time during the week. Now, I know you've got Champions League. There's many a time during the week. If you've got a game in the Champions League on a Tuesday, even if you did, you can still work Thursday on Wednesday, you know, after a game. You don't have to train hard, but you can bring in a player that, like, say Fellaini was United, he didn't play in the Champions League game, and you're going to go with a different... Managers are deciding their teams before the Champions League game for the Premiership game or game after. They've decided. Fergie did that all the time. He would leave
people out. And also, Gab, you're saying you people. What do you mean our managers? Because most of them are foreign.
No, I'm talking about... Right, but I'd argue that the ones who actually get their teams to play with a certain very distinct identity, and I'll include Tony Pulis in that as well as Wenger. I think it's because they've... Or Moyes at Everton. It's because they've generally had a stable group of players, and necessarily they've had a long time. I mean, Everton rarely played more than 42, 44, 45 games in a season. He's had more time to work with them. He was able to develop a team with an identity. Right. This is what gets me. The same thing with Arsenal. It's like, I've bought Olivier Giroud. I'm training the whole summer to try to play with Olivier Giroud. But hey, if Luis Suarez comes up, who's going to make different runs, who's going to be a different type of player, who's going to want different service, I'm just going to expect my players to just change everything all of a sudden. I don't think that that's good team building. I mean, sometimes I agree, needs must. But by the same token, I think there's a reason why the last couple years, and Mourinho said this, and he said it to you, I believe, Dicko, because I read your piece on Saturday. There's a reason why nobody's played particularly well among the top teams in England the last couple of years, and why the top teams in England perhaps were a lot better in Mourinho's day. Let's move on to everybody's favorite part of the show, quick hits. Chelsea celebrate the return of Jose Mourinho with a 2-0 win over Hull. It looked like a terrifying beatdown in the first 20-25 minutes. Dicko, did we learn anything, or was it more the case of a shockingly overmatched opponent?
I think we learn that, you know, Jose brings that, Cancel bring that intensity. I mean, there's clearly a sort of first day emotion to it. You know, he clearly just has that ability to whip up a certain fervour in certain matches, which I'm sure we'll see, you know, later through the season. And there was a degree of stage fright from Hull. But I think it's going to be fascinating watching Chelsea and seeing if Mourinho can make all these little flighty players turn into a captivating team.
I'm hoping Hull play better than they did, because I thought it was absolute dreck. It was like Derby or something from a few years back. Between them, Philippe Coutinho, Iago Aspas and Daniel Sturridge seem to add up to more than Luis Suarez, as Liverpool defeated Stoke 1-0. But to be fair, probably could have been a lot more. But for Asmir Begovic, Cass, are you optimistic that Liverpool will be just fine even if Suarez leaves?
Well, between sort of 6th and 8th, maybe. I certainly don't see top four. Coutinho, I really like. I think he's proving to be a real talent. And Daniel Sturridge, since he stepped into the boots of supposedly not good enough at Chelsea and gone to Anfield, he's really shined. I mean,
Aspas is basically Suarez without debating.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, look, it's a long, long season. I'm always sceptical about Liverpool and still feel they're still nowhere near the top four for me.
Now, Ian Holloway, one of the best people in the world, is very angry that referee Mark Clattenburg awarded a penalty for an Aaron Lennon cross that hit Dean Moxey's outstretched arm and did not award one after Stephen Dobby was body checked. George, I guess that's what the rules say, but do you have sympathy for Ollie, especially when he goes further and he talks about little clubs not getting decisions against supposedly big ones like Spurs?
No, I view that in exactly the same way as I kind of view David Moyes' comments about Manchester United's fixture list being a gigantic right-wing conspiracy orchestrated by the CIA. I mean, that kind of made me smile, because it was pure Fergie, pure paranoia, and this is just Holloway setting out the stall, setting out the narrative for the season that if Crystal Palace are going to survive, it's going to be us against the rest of the world.
Now, Skinner is pointing out to me that Tottenham had zero penalties awarded to them last season, but perhaps that's just because they didn't have very many fleet-footed players who like to run at opponents. Speaking of Tottenham, Gary Jacobs reporting that they're on the verge of signing Willian for $27 million. Of course, that would be Angie's Willian, formerly of Shakhtar Donetsk. Now, reports that Liverpool are in the bidding for him as well. But what interests me is, if Spurs are moving for Willian, is that a hint that they're ready to spend some of that Gareth Bale money and therefore Bale will be going, Dicko?
Well, they've already spent 50 million quid of it this summer. I even did some research on this this morning's phone. Tottenham insiders, sources, etc., say that Bale remains probable. Dealing with Real Madrid is always a nightmare. Miguel dealing with Daniel Levy is always a nightmare. But it looks like it will happen. It looks like Spurs are already spending an awful lot of that Gareth Bale money, and interesting, Willian just strengthens the conviction that Bale will be dancing around the Bernabeu.
When David Moyes was around, Ross Barkley didn't get much of a look in. Now, with Roberto Martinez, he looks a bit special. Cass, was it a question of the kid needing to mature, or just a case of maybe Martinez seeing something Moyes did not?
Well, he certainly looks a player that, on judging on Saturday, and it is only Saturday's performance, that
he's a monster.
Absolute physical.
Forget Fellaini, sign this guy.
That's what I'm thinking, Dad. But they broke the bank to get Wayne Rooney, Man United. And when you see that, now it's only David Moyes must know how good he can be, because what he showed in the game on Saturday, and it is obviously he came into the team last year and he spent the time a bit out alone on Sheffield Wednesday, but he's got the absolute pace and power and just smashed everybody, and his passing, David Moyes must know how good he was. If he really, I actually if someone said to me Baines and Fellaini, I'd rather go Seamus Coleman and Barkley.
I was saying the same thing about
I tell you,
I know about Coleman defensively, but you know,
no,
but still
he's on another level, I tell you.
Well, there we go. Cass and I agree on this. Exactly. Who needs Fellaini and Baines when you got Barkley and Coleman? Paolo Di Canio made a lot of changes over the summer, but Sunderland fell at home to Fulham in the opener 1-0. Di Canio, who is extremely wise and usually right, says it doesn't matter because they played well and the results will come. George, do you share his optimism?
Well, I certainly share his excitement. I mean, it's about time something different happened at Sunderland. 6 years in the Premier League, it's all been a bit samey. It's all been a bit mediocre. Moments of promise that have then faded away. And at least there's now something very, very different, a new identity at Sunderland. So they played pretty well in the first half. It tailed off quite badly. I suppose you have to expect that when you've brought in 10 new players and started five of them. The one note of caution I would say is that looking at the fixture list, that was one that they really could have done with starting off well in, because their next home sequence is Arsenal, Liverpool, Man U, Newcastle, Man City, Chelsea, Spurs.
I've got one for you, Gav. La Liga is up and running. Do you see anything that makes you feel different about the outcome of a two-horse race in La Liga?
No, not really. I mean, judging, I mean, Barcelona were ridiculous. They were 6-0 up by halftime. Real Madrid, much more, I think, of a work in progress. Carlo Ancelotti making a very brave choice, I thought, in dropping Iker Casillas, much like your pal Mourinho did last year, Cass. It's weird. It looked to me like Real Madrid were ahead, given all the bad stuff that happened to Barca over the summer. But Tata Martino couldn't have asked for a better start. And I'll tell you what, Cesc Fabregas, he set up four of the goals. It felt as if the whole team was built around him. From what I saw, I didn't see a player who's even contemplating or ever contemplated leaving. That's all we've got time for this week. We'll be back the same time, same place next week, unless you choose to listen to this at a different time, in a different location. The wonders of technology. And no, I do not write my own stuff. You can thank Chris Skinner for that witticism. Thanks to my panel. It's Tony Cascarino. It's George Culkin. And, of course, it's Matt Dickinson. You can go to thetimes.co.uk for news, analysis, reaction, and goals. Every goal, every game, everywhere in the Premier League. You can also write to us, as so many of you do, every single week. GamePodcast@thetimes.co.uk. We're all on Twitter, and we all love to hear from you all the time, especially Cass. So please, reach out and touch us, but not in that way. Till next time. Bye-bye.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.